Now, the musical Hamilton has become a cultural phenomenon, unlike anything I've ever seen with any other play or musical. There seems to be some character or story or storyline that impacts just about everyone. But still, not everyone is getting the message. I found this letter, originally sent to the Denver Post after Hamilton appeared there, quite amusing. The writer writes, "All I can say is musical standards in this country have gone into the toilet. I found Hamilton to be one of the most offensive shows I've ever seen. A black George Washington, a black James Madison, a black Aaron Burr, and a rapping and strutting Thomas Jefferson. Atrocious. I would love to see the reaction of our black communities if theater or film producers produced the life of Reverend Martin Luther King Jr. or Frederick Douglass and mounted an all-white cast." I'm sure members of Star King would be reacting quite differently. There are many different themes in this musical adaptation, and 46 songs in total, and we can only touch on a few of them in the service. Let me just give you some background to Alexander Hamilton and the other characters who you've heard from and will be hearing from in the rest of the service. Alexander Hamilton was born illegitimate in 1755 to a Scotsman and a French Huguenot woman on the island of Nevis in the Caribbean. After moving the family to the Danish island of St. Croix, his father abandoned them when Alexander was 10, and his mother died of illness 3 years later. He became a ward of her family, but despite these setbacks, he succeeded in educating himself and made a great impression with his intelligence and diligence while working with the accounts of an import-export firm. His abilities were spotted by the local Presbyterian minister, who raised money to send him to college in America at age 17. It was at Princeton where he first met Aaron Burr, the man who would later kill him. He passed the entrance exams but decided it was not for him and instead went to New York City to King's College, now Columbia University. Hamilton took an early role as the American Revolutionary War began. In 1777, he became a senior aide to George Washington in running the new Continental Army. He met his wife-to-be, Eliza, in February 1780 and married her in December of that year. She was the daughter of a revolutionary general that came from a prominent Dutch family in upstate New York. After the war, Hamilton was elected as a representative to the Congress of the Confederation from New York. He resigned to practice law and founded the Bank of New York. He was a leader in seeking to replace the weak national government and wrote 51 of the 85 installments of the highly regarded Federalist Papers, which to this day remain the single most important reference for a constitutional interpretation. When Washington was elected the first president, Hamilton was chosen as the first Secretary of the Treasury Department and served as a trusted member of Washington's first cabinet. He was a nationalist who emphasized strong central government and successfully argued that the implied powers of the Constitution provided the legal authority to fund the national debt, assume states' debts, and create the government-backed Bank of the United States. It's for this reason that the image of Hamilton has appeared on our $10 bill since 1929. Interestingly, in 2015, Obama's Treasury Secretary announced that the portrait of Hamilton would be replaced by the portrait of an as-yet-undecided woman, starting in 2020. However, according to Wikipedia, due to the surging popularity of the musical Hamilton, this decision was reversed in 2016, and instead, a woman would appear on the $20 bill, and that woman was former slave and abolitionist Harriet Tubman. Unfortunately, the new Treasury Secretary, Steve Mnuchin, appointed by you-know-who, called this into question last year when he told CNBC, "Ultimately, we will be looking at this issue. It's not something I'm focused on at the moment." Now, Hamilton played a central role in the Federalist Party, which dominated national and state politics until it lost the election of 1800 to Jefferson's Democratic-Republican Party, partly because of his opposition to the second president, John Adams' reelection. Jefferson and Aaron Burr tied for the presidency in the Electoral College in 1801, and Hamilton helped to defeat Burr, whom he found unprincipled. In losing the election, Burr became vice president. Hamilton, by his actions, made lifelong enemies of both John Adams and Aaron Burr. We hear of Burr's resentment for the rising star of Hamilton in the song Jim sang called "Wait For It." He first sings of his wife, Theodosia, whom he met during the war and had an affair with while she was married to a British officer. When her husband died of yellow fever, they were married, but tragically, she died 12 years later. After contemplating his own misfortunes and Hamilton's successes, Burr decides to hang on for now and lie in wait, feeling that his time to shine is coming soon. Hamilton continued his legal and business activities in New York City and was active in ending the legality of the international slave trade. When Vice President Burr ran for governor of New York State in 1804, Hamilton once again crusaded against him as unworthy. Burr lost this election, taking further offense to Hamilton, and challenged him to a duel. Despite the fact that his oldest son had died in a duel 3 years earlier, in order to preserve his honor, Hamilton accepted the challenge, and in the duel was shot and mortally wounded by Burr and died the next day on July 12, 1804, at age 49. Burr was still serving as vice president at the time, and the duel was actually illegal, but all charges against him were eventually dropped. He was later tried for treason on unrelated charges in 1807, and although he was acquitted, all of Burr's hopes for a political comeback had been dashed, and he fled America and his creditors for Europe, and later fathered several illegitimate children. It was a far cry from a former senator who was one vote away from being our third president. He had achieved his vengeance on Hamilton, but seemingly lost everything else in the process. As for Hamilton, despite his great achievements, he obviously had his flaws. He could be ruthlessly ambitious and consequently made a lot of enemies. He also carried on an adulterous affair with a married woman 11 years his junior in 1791 while serving as the Secretary of Treasury, and his wife was staying in Albany with her family and their children. He was blackmailed, and in order to keep it quiet, he made a series of payments to her husband, James Reynolds. 6 years later, these payments became public, and in order to prove that the payments weren't part of a corrupt act as the Secretary of the Treasury, which would prevent him from further public service, he publicly admitted the details of the affair and payments, a confession which humiliated his wife. We'll hear of her bitterness towards him for these actions in the song Burn that Sarah will sing after Dave's sermon. In it, she sings, "You published the letters she wrote you. You told the whole world how you brought this girl into our bed. In clearing your name, you have ruined our lives." History doesn't record how Eliza and Alexander were able to come to terms with his infidelity and humiliation of her. In our own time, former Governor Arnold Schwarzenegger and his wife Maria Shriver weren't able to get over the humiliation of a similar public infidelity when it became apparent he had fathered a child with their housekeeper many years earlier. But we get a glimpse of the process the Hamiltons followed for this recovery in what is to me the most touching song of the whole musical, It's Quiet Uptown. This will be the final song we'll sing. In it you'll hear, "See them walking in the park, long after dark, taking in the sights of the city. They are trying to do the unimaginable. After what seems like a long time of trying to work things out, they finally achieve the unimaginable. There are moments that the words don't reach. There is a grace too powerful to name. They are standing in the garden, Alexander by Eliza's side. She takes his hand. Forgiveness. Can you imagine?" And she truly does forgive him. After his death, she lives an amazing 50 more years to age 97 and spends a large part of that time trying to preserve his legacy by working with their son to arrange his papers and publish his biography. In the postlude, you'll hear the song, "Who Lives, Who Dies, Who Tells Your Story," which talks about her efforts to tell this story. As for Eliza, left as a widow with 8 children, she was passionate about the lives of all children. Along with several other social activists, she was one of the founders of the first private orphanage in New York City, the New York Orphan Asylum Society. She was tireless in her efforts to raise money and support the society, becoming its director, where she remained deeply involved until her late 90s. Eliza truly embodied the sentiments expressed by her husband in the play when he said, "God help me and forgive me. I want to build something that is going to outlive me." Finally, the role of King George III doesn't need much explanation. He's a humorous interjection into the Hamilton narrative who tries to second-guess the actions the founding fathers were taking.
I'm David Middleton. Before we continue, I'd like to acknowledge those of you that were here yesterday for Bob Stortz's memorial. He loves song and music, so we'll continue with him in our thoughts and our hearts today. In preparing for the service, we had to give thought to the intent behind carrying it out. Our church is involved in ongoing effort to bring authenticity to performances that involve the work of people of color. We had an interesting back and forth about what it meant to be a majority white congregation and perform songs, most of which were written with the intent of being sung by people of color. We discussed the difference between mounting a full-scale production and a recital-type setting. We shared different perspectives, our own individual levels of awareness, and engaged in conversation without blame. So I'm personally proud of how this was done. Hamilton was an amazing play about one of our nation's most influential founding fathers. The 55 men at the Second Constitutional Convention are often held in high esteem, even revered for the manner in which they laid the foundations for the development of U.S. government democratic institutions and for the preservation of individual liberty. Many have lauded and fought to preserve these constitutional rights and protections, and this struggle continues today. I believe that too many, the founding fathers serve as a reference point from which leaders from the past and present are compared. Policy decisions of today are often referred to as if they abide by the intent of what the founding fathers had envisioned. I've heard people say things like, oh, the founding fathers must be rolling over in their graves when they hear about such and such modern policy. I hold the belief that the founding fathers are not simply reference points stuck in time whom we should refer back to. They themselves were part of a larger ongoing historical narrative. Their beliefs and choices were part of a reaction to past injustice that they endured, while at the same time a testament to the possibility of a new, more promising future. I have also heard considerable debate about the standard by which we should judge the founding fathers and other influential leaders of the past. The question arises, how much deference or admiration should be paid to these individuals who were clearly men with flaws, whose decisions were at times unjust, and their choices and beliefs often reveal hypocrisy? We know that 17 of the 55 delegates at the Second Constitutional Convention enslaved people of color at the same time they spoke about liberty, justice, and freedom. I personally have learned the importance of facing honestly and completely the damage caused by the actions of these individuals, the cost in human lives and suffering, costs which continue to this day. Some argue that we should be wary about honoring these individuals, or others like President Woodrow Wilson, for example, who openly held racist beliefs and engaged in discriminatory actions because their choices that they made were too great a stain on their legacy. We are left to question whether it is right to honor them with street names, colleges, currency, and the like, even though they had made many positive contributions to our society. However, I believe that when we frequently engage in these debates about a very select few individuals who have been discussed at length by our historians and have been memorialized in countless ways across our country, we are narrowing our vision and focus about what history truly is. It is important to discuss the significance of the Revolutionary War and the Federalist Papers. However, of greater concern to me is the understanding that the version of history that we know and debate that is referenced in our history books is incomplete. It is frequently a story told by a few, glamorizing a few, often providing us with all too simple explanations and cause and effect flowcharts. I argue it is everyday people like you and me who we might not read about in our history books who take important steps to bring about the change needed in our society. People who fight for equal rights for all and protections that were called for in the Constitution but are not yet fully realized. I would like to highlight a few examples from the civil rights era. We know the story of Rosa Parks, But do we pay tribute to the courage displayed by Claudette Colvin, who months before Rosa Parks refused to give up her seat to a white person on a bus? She spoke the truth in this moment, saying, "It is my constitutional right to sit here as much as that lady. I paid my fare. It is my constitutional right." In a later interview, she said that she felt as though Sojourner Truth was pushing down on one shoulder and Harriet Tubman pushing down on the other, saying, "Sit down, girl." She was arrested and thrown in jail. When released, she was under constant fear of retaliation that she and her family might be subject to. The NAACP briefly considered using Colvin's case to challenge segregation laws, but decided against it, in part because of her age and the fact that she was an unwed mother who might attract too much negative attention in such a public legal battle. Our children learn about the Reverend Dr. Martin Luther King Jr. in school, but are they made aware of the contributions of Bayard Rustin, the chief organizer of the 1963 March on Washington, and the leading strategist of civil rights movement? He endured criticism and arguments that his sexual orientation was distracting or detracting from his effectiveness within the movement. Behind the scenes, he was a giant agitating and strategizing to end segregation. And in 2013, he was posthumously recognized with a Presidential Medal of Freedom. We know about the Little Rock Nine, how the integration of schools in the South was a tremendous struggle. Horrifying bullying took place on a daily basis. However, in these historic series of events, there were many examples of ordinary people like you and me who contributed to bring about the much-needed change, and they truly made history happen. We might not have studied them in school, but they were instrumental in bringing about this seismic change in our society. Terrence Roberts, one of the Little Rock Nine, recalled in his article, "Fear is Portable," "Algebra class was a haven for me. The teacher, Miss Helen Conrad, let it be known from day one that she would not tolerate no nonsense from anyone who opposed my presence. She was emphatic about it, and the class responded accordingly." He goes on to say, "In this class, I met Robin Woods, a white student who shared her textbook with me. Since my books and supplies were routinely destroyed by fellow students, I would come to class most often with no supplies. Robin simply pulled her desk next to mine and we shared her book. Her act of kindness was interpreted as a violation of a social code that outlawed any contact between black students and white students, especially black males and white females. Robin did not allow that kind of thinking to interfere with her choices." At Little Rock, many people stood by, some jeered and vociferously protested integration. Others took action and contributed in ways that they knew they could. They may seem like simple acts, like teachers protecting their students, or students sharing with others in times of need, but these individuals help bring about change in society. I believe that the Constitution was written with some level of awareness of the potentiality for the events that we are dealing with today. However, I believe that it is our duty as citizens to engage, act, and hold our leaders accountable. Frank Burton, can I get an amen?
Amen.
We ourselves are part of this ongoing historical narrative. When people look back at our generation, at the events of our time, how will we be remembered? What did we do about the clear attacks on the very democratic institutions the Founding Fathers established? When the separate branches of government were undermined and criticized for partisan purposes? What did we do when defense spending spiked at the same time that programs designed to benefit those in need were cut and homelessness soared? What did we do when bigotry and xenophobia sadly became more commonplace in our society, when immigrant families were under threat of being separated? What did we do when our earth was threatened by global warming while our short-sighted government leaders were selfishly pursuing policies of deregulation? When the corrupt head of the EPA took measures to undermine in virtually every conceivable way the agency he was appointed to lead? And this, as you know, is just a small list of the challenges that we are facing today. My friends, we must face these challenges as Hamilton did at Yorktown, quoted in the play as saying, "We must fight up close, seize the moment, and stay in it." As Lin-Manuel Miranda writes, history has its eyes on you. And what struck me is a quote that was quite UU in its sentiments. He says, "And when my prayers to God were met with indifference, I picked up a pen and wrote my own deliverance." Bayard Rustin posited, "We need in every bay and every community a group of angelic troublemakers." Will we be the individuals that Mr. Rustin and so many that came before us have been waiting for? In short, my friends, I believe that we are the ones that we've been waiting for. And in conclusion, I will end with two quotes from Alexander Hamilton in the song "The World Was Wide Enough." "America, you great unfinished symphony, you sent for me. You let me make a difference, a place where even orphan immigrants can leave their fingerprints and rise up." And lastly, legacy. What is legacy? It's planting seeds in a garden that you never get to see.